I'm feeling pretty grungy this morning. Last night I took my 8-year-old son for a overnight camping trip. I've forgotten, you know, what it's like to sleep in a and I can report that my son slept very well all night. I can tell he was sleeping really well. So, but I figure if there's any place where it's okay to be grungy, it's Holden. So I didn't shave.
Right? You're not the only grungy one.
Yeah. Okay. So, no technology. You know, I gave that big spiel in the beginning on Monday about technology. You probably got the impression I'm sort of a technophobe. I'm actually, I describe myself as a technophilic Luddite, meaning that I love technology but kind of feel bad about it. And I'm trying to cut back. So despite everything I said about Neil Postman, you know, I'm in, unfortunately. But with no technology today, and, you know, it's interesting that we've spent the first 10 minutes here talking about science, and I swore to a few people before that we were not going to do any science this morning. But I do want us to get into the conversations. Someone asked, is what we're doing now similar to what we're doing in the NIH project? And the answer is yes. This is a very small subset of that. The program that we're doing is much more extensive. That does not mean that if you did the full-fledged program, you're guaranteed at the end of this to have an outcome in which you have some degree of certainty about your position on any particular policy matter, though. I have to say, as I said yesterday, I feel like I've done my job if I can convince people that tolerating many uncomfortable and difficult conversations without an immediate outcome is a very positive, good thing. And the conditions within which it's possible for us to come to some thought out policy statements within our churches, perhaps, and perhaps within our own minds about the position we're going to take. Yesterday it was interesting that Don Heinz, he's over here, I see this morning, he talked about that in his mind. He was thinking through what we were talking about, and then all of a sudden had a flip in it because he was thinking about it, had this big change in his head by simply changing the perspective from which he was asking the question. Well, it may not seem like it, but it takes a lot of work to get to the point where you put yourself in an environment where those flips can take place and insight can take place. And most people, they want, like my daughter, you know, if you can't say it in 2 or 3 sentences, Dad, you know, just drop it.
You know. You go on and on and on.
Yeah. My son, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, but there's that blah, 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 once you get inside it and you for the 10th or 12th time, butt up against the same problem, right? That 13th time, you may at some point have a perspectival shift that gets you into 14 down the way. So I believe in what I do and what we're doing in itself as an outcome. See what I'm saying? As an outcome, it's satisfying to me. It may not be to you, particularly if you have a very strong background in the natural sciences. But it's very, very, because it's very, very difficult to say, yes, this was something that was useful and valuable. And also, yes, I don't know what the immediate application of it is for me right now at this point in time. With all the discussion technologies, I think that's true, especially for genetics. So, okay, this morning, I would like for us to dive into a couple of case studies, and ending with most of our time spent on a case study dealing with stem cells and human embryo discussion. First, I just want to quickly just give to you a case that I advertised we would do yesterday and didn't do because we got into our conversation. We'll just go through it real quickly, and just to put it there in your mind as an illustration. The point is, I mean, if again, building on, since most of you were here yesterday at Sansone, building on that conversation just a little bit there, that I've said this a number of times, that the whole, you know, debate about abortion, the 60s, 70s, and so on, that there's a connection to those debates, but because of IVF, you know, developing in the 70s and so on, you combine that with the abortion debate and so on, and you end up with all of what we're able to do now with genetics, you end up with a whole complex of problems that just weren't thought about back then. So that same testing that we were looking at yesterday, where you could test for some terrible disease, right? Huntington's, say, which we looked at yesterday, with the intention of aborting a fetus that has some disease that you know, in this case, with 100% certainty that it would express itself and manifest itself in a disease, that you might consider aborting the fetus on that basis. That all makes it, perhaps, even if you're opposed to abortion and so on, at least you can imagine someone who isn't opposed to abortion using the kind of technologies to do things that you would vaguely think would be a good thing. The elimination of disease is the premise of medicine, isn't it? I mean, that's a good, that's a sort of an understood, assumed good. To get rid of disease is a good thing. Okay. Genetics, all this stuff is saying, be careful what you wish for. Okay, so, that also means that we're assuming that we're talking about people who have autonomy. That is to say, people who are basically going to be left alone vis-a-vis the government to make choices on their own, right? And because that's the case, we're going to end up with cases like we had yesterday with the woman testing her fetus for Huntington's with the intention of finding out genetic information about her prospective spouse, right? Also, people, you know, you may have already heard this one, where they will get pregnant with the intention of aborting the fetus to use the fetal tissue to treat Parkinson's disease. It turns out to be a fairly effective way of treating Parkinson's disease. You use the fetal tissue. So what does it mean then to use the reproductive process for using that tissue for treating a disease? Or needing an identical twin, or needing a sibling who can donate marrow for leukemia, perhaps? Right? So these are questions. The case study I'm just giving you here, again, I don't want to spend a lot of time discussing it because of time, but I did want to, at least because I advertised it, put it on here. A couple who comes to a pastor who are deaf and who want to get some genetic testing to see if their fetus is going to be deaf with the intention of aborting the fetus if it can hear. If it can hear. Now, you know, we would have a very different case here if it were the, you know, that it couldn't hear. And if you end up with a position here where you begin to understand all the dynamics that lead the couple to sincerely want to have a deaf child, you know, you believe in the concept of deaf culture and that there's some advantages in fact of being deaf, perhaps, that you have enhanced perceptions in other ways and so on. And you also can be sympathetic with them that they don't know how to be parents to a child who can hear, and so on and so forth. You might get in a position where you end up perhaps starting out with what I call a yuck response to this. Wait a minute, you know, you can't do this. To having that little flip that we saw Dr. Heinz having yesterday, flipping the head, you know, thinking that maybe this is an okay thing. Then the question is, what about blindness? What about someone who just randomly decides they want to make sure they have some kid with Huntington's? They have some kind of pathology that wants to produce the suffering somehow. You know, in other words, there's nothing right now. We don't have any regulations that are able to monitor people's intentions. We just assumed that the intentions are the kinds of things we thought about in the 60s and 70s. We didn't think about these kinds of things. We have to think about them now. We have to think about it now. If not at the state level of regulation, at least at the level of pastors and friends giving advice, that's pretty important. So again, we're not going to do this one. The other one, then the next one here, is on genetic research and the kind of the weird things we can do now with genetic research. This is from session 3. First case study. This is an actual case reported on 2001, Oregon Health Sciences University, the Oregon Primate Center, Dr. Chan. This was a rhesus monkey and they successfully inserted a gene which codes for, now you know, understand how this works, a gene that produces the amino acid sequence that produces the protein that then produces a substance that glows green. Okay? So they just wanted that so they could have an easy marker to see if it was there. Well, they succeeded with this particular monkey. They named it Andy, A-N-D-I. So here's a non-human primate, or rhesus monkey, where they successfully have managed to insert this sequence into the embryo, and then it leads to the transmission of this gene through the differentiation process, through the whole process of cell division, so it's in every cell of the monkey's body. Why did they do this? One of the reasons is to prove that they could insert human genes into the rhesus monkey successfully so that they could then perhaps create susceptibility to human diseases that would then allow them to do research legally on the rhesus monkey instead of doing it on humans. Also, potential research here for being able to do the kind of thing that I think, again, Don is interested in, the possibility of somehow basically doing treatment before you get the disease, right? Actually going in and not destroying the embryo, but doing something genetically to fix things without destroying the embryo. So these things show that it's at least somewhat possible. This one I would like us to just talk a little bit about, if we could, the whole idea of creating chimera to for research purposes. On the back, the questions here. What would be the questions you would ask if you were a member of an ethics board? Are there ethical concerns that you might have about the fact that the experiment was being performed in a rhesus monkey rather than, say, a mouse, a nematode? In other words, do you have in your mind a kind of hierarchy of moral worth in terms of the animal kingdom? Will this case study, you know, end up making vegetarians out of you? I don't know. So what should regulations be different for different classes of animals? Should we allow transgenic experiments such as this one? We've already inserted human genes in some species to produce proteins used to treat human diseases. And then we have the joke there. Look, lady, you're the one who asked for a famous movie star with dark hair, strong nose, and deep-set eyes. Got what she wanted. What are the possible risks of inserting human DNA sequences into a rhesus monkey? Is it possible that we might create a half-human, half-monkey hybrid? This is my biology professor sometimes talks about this. You know, what's going to happen the first time we produce a non-human primate that has more human characteristics than we're comfortable with, right? Yeah. Genetic manipulation of germline cells is the ultimate trajectory of genetic research. What does this kind of potential for control over our evolution and the evolution of other species mean for us? So let's just talk a little bit about this. What's your reaction to this kind of research?
Could you just talk a little bit, I know you want to move away from science, but could you just talk a little bit about the science? So at what point does the jellyfish turn the monkey into a jellyfish?
Right.
Like, are we just taking a tiny bit and it's still mostly monkey or what?
Well, the problem is that you'd have to, you know, they talked about DNA splicing and all that, recombinant DNA. You don't hear researchers talking about that so much. I mean, it's still part of the on the agenda. But the method by which proteins are going to be produced is through artificial chromosomes, where you end up putting an artificial gene into a chromosome, putting it into the body, and then that chromosome that will only be triggered, will only begin to express itself in the presence of a hormone, an artificial hormone. So if you wondered about that, I mean, you know, my son still doesn't have much hair on his body and his voice is still squeaky like Mickey Mouse and so on and so forth. And then at some point, he starts changing, you know, and so on. There's energy. Why? I mean, the genetic code, so why hasn't that expressed itself? Because it hasn't been exposed to the presence of testosterone. you get the flood of testosterone, the genes start doing their thing, and all of a sudden their body changes. Well, you can do that artificially through chromosomes. It turns out to be a hell of a lot easier to do that than to do recombinant DNA splicing and so on and so forth. So, for example, you might find someone who is who's really deficient in the human growth hormone. So you might insert an artificial chromosome that is designed to a gene that's designed to express itself only in the presence of a certain hormone. The kid reaches a certain age and so on, you give him the hormone, it expresses itself and they have a growth spurt, right? That would be the kind of idea that we're talking about. Yeah.
Let me jump down to number five and raise a concern that I have. I don't know whether or how many are aware that there was a disastrous biological attack on corn and soybeans, and they were all the same version of corn and soybeans, and so it demolished basically a year's production of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about genetic manipulation of germline cells, that assumes we know what we're doing. And one of the things that some of our friends are concerned about, and I am too, is loss of genetic diversity, which can accommodate to different kinds of difficult situations. They're trying to now mine the maize, the corn, genes from South America, because there are many, many more available there than are here. We have, two or three kinds now. We've standardized on that. And I get very nervous when we talk about us deciding what is quality.
Yeah, you do end up being more susceptible. You know, why I think I, again, not with this group maybe, but with the flu outbreak and right. So on, a certain number of people survived, certain people didn't, largely because of the genetic diversity. Apparently, I saw the headlines in the newspaper, 50% of all of us are going to get the swine flu. It's actually tragic because the flu in the 1918, I think it was, outbreak, the Spanish flu was in three stages.
Yeah.
The first outbreak wasn't very big, the next one was big, and so it turns out that this strain appears at this point not to have mutated into something more deadly, so we're lucky that way. But it still might, and it looks like a lot of us are going to get it this fall. Why they couldn't have gotten the research just a little bit sooner to be able to give us those shots, I don't know. But nevertheless, I guess we're going to get two this year, September and October, for this swine flu. But the point is that diversity is evolution's way, if you want to describe it at the lower level, without the theological overlay. It's that way of surviving. Evolution doesn't care about you.
Yeah.
Personally, really, if you think about it, doesn't care about you. It wants to just make sure you live long enough to propagate. Then after that, you end up with sore backs and get old and so on. So it's a problem. As far as evolution, they don't the telomerase and the end of those things. It's going to keep clipping off. You can't do anything about it. And as we're
not yet.
We're not only going to have to leave the village. We're going to have to leave, at some point. So all of that's care, but the evolution wants to make sure we survive long enough to propagate, Plato's thing about all the best men having intercourse as often as possible. All the best.
But that was Plato's definition of best.
Right. Well, it was his
someone else
projection onto throwing up a picture, he was doing, of a possible world.
Sure.
But anyway, taking that into account, so what about any other kind of response to this idea of crossing species, particularly with humans? Yeah.
Well, it said on the front that if they were successful in putting this luminescent
jellyfish
thing into the rhesus monkey, then the next step would be to insert some kind of gene that would produce human diseases so that they could work on finding cures for using humans. And I saw some sort of qualitative difference between that and splicing something into cows to make a cure for a disease or even missing nutrients or something for children, then, I mean, you know, in one
so
case you're going to...
This has already been...
Sort of misuse the monkey. You know?
Oh, I thought we were going to say that we're already doing this in some sense, because we have already put some human sequences in cows to produce certain proteins in the milk that
mm-hmm.
are then used for various kinds of things.
That was
so
a
is this a morally image. Different kind of thing?
Yeah.
I guess that's what you're
doing.
Right,
to
right,
say.
Right, yeah.
Thank
sure.
you.
Yeah, I think you could get pretty easily sidetracked from all the genetic questions onto, you know, animal testing, primate testing, and, you know, your question about is it possible to create a half-human, half-monkey hybrid, and how would we feel about all this as if, whoa, now that it's looking so human, we wish we don't want to be doing this to it, you know. And a lot of people say, well, monkeys are far more human than people realize, you know, and you just don't know, and you're a sentient creature and all, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that question four takes you off into that whole other territory apart from the some of the genetic questions, if it weren't a matter of harming an animal.
So for you, the central category for a moral relevance, if you want to put it that way, has to do with how we understand non-human primates in terms of their place within creation or how we value them, whether we should be harming them, any, you know, using them in research at all, perhaps?
That might be the primary question. Are you harming another creature? Or is this genetic researcher doing, you know, harm less? Is it something that the creature will still grow and
it
flourish?
Makes an assumption that there is not a moral value in the creature because it is in the service of bettering humankind, which not everyone would buy into, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, if you end up with the principle that whatever you do needs to serve the animal that you're experimenting on, it would pretty much do away with a lot of animal research.
Yeah.
All the way down the line.
I'd like to broaden that just a little bit. We can make monkeys who now luminesce, and that might be kind of a neat thing. Maybe they become sexually attracted to the others.
Maybe that's it, yeah.
But, you know, let me now do a thought process. At what point do the human attributes that you attribute to this monkey turn it into a human?
Well, it gets us into our next, segues into our next discussion, which is going to be about what it means to be a person. What is it that we value such that we identify each other as persons, such that we assume that there's something there other than or more than a non-human primate, right? And,
and all we have
is sort of behavioral characteristics.
Yeah, it may be a continuum.
It may be a continuum. But continuums, unfortunately, you know, then produce a lot of difficulties, right? Because if it's a continuum, what does a continuum mean in terms of being a person? What
is a person?
Yeah. Well, that's okay. That's our next case then.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, David.
So this one I'm going to give you actually the introductory page on... that introduces the case study just because it's I think it's better than anything I would say spontaneously after sleeping with my son. So I did that this morning. Here's the actual case. This is a little bit of a long one, and so even if we kind of, I'd like to see if we could just read it together and then just discuss it here. It's a little long.
Yeah, we only got page 3. It's coming.
He's hard to interrupt.
Oh, no, sorry. The numbers don't mean anything on any of these. These are
pages.
So page 3 is what we want to look at first, and then we'll look at the case study. As I said, I had an opportunity to go out to the Roslin Institute in 2004 to visit Ian Wilmot, who cloned Dolly with his embryologist, Paul D'Souza. And I was surprised they let me come out. You know, who am I? You know, I was just there on sabbatical and so on. They were used to crackpots, you know, taking shots at them. But once I introduced myself as humble a way as I could, you know, I have this little researcher going on human embryos, and it turns out that they wanted me to come out and learn about what I was doing because they were just about to apply for the license to clone human embryos for doing research on ALS, on motor neuron disease. Yeah. They wanted to clone human embryos so they could do research on these defective human embryos to help unlock the problem of motor neuron disease. So he invited me out. I had a great afternoon with them, but it was all, you know, they had some interest in having me out to try and see if they could learn enough about this to help. Is this a tape one?
We don't have the case study back here.
Pardon?
We don't have the case study back here.
Here, I can show
them. Okay. Yeah, I don't have enough case studies, maybe. I don't know. But so here it goes. So way back in 1978, proposal to do research on human embryos, okay, Pierre Suppart. His proposal was instrumental in the development of the first policy statement on embryonics research in the United States. In 1983, in defense of research on human embryos, he writes, because of its human origin, the embryo undoubtedly deserves to be paid a high degree of respect when treated as a research object. What higher form of respect could be paid to human embryos than to ask them to provide vital information leading to the alleviation of some types of human infertility, the prevention of birth defects, contraceptive and cancer research, and the actual causes of natural embryonic losses in man. And just notice the language, you know, the connotations of the language. I just love that paragraph because, you know, the one you think he's talking about, degree of respect when treated as a research object. An object. Okay. And then you the next sentence, I want to pay great respect to this object, I guess, we pay to human embryos. And then you want to ask them. You know, you want to ask them to provide this information. You know, as though you're talking to them, saying, could you put, you know, there's just something really
naive. They have a chance of saying no.
Pardon?
They really have a chance of saying no.
Right, I know. It's such a, you know, again, this is very early on in the debate. But so I put down here, you know, what an odd statement. It's an odd statement to me. On the one hand, he seems to be saying that all human embryos should be treated with great respect. On the other hand, the way we are to show our respect is to do research on them, kill them, and thank them for their help. Okay, it's a little provocative, isn't it? Advisory board after advisory board, and I've noticed this in 2004 when I was doing all this kind of research stuff, commission after commission, policy statement, all seem to wrestle in an unsatisfactory way with the question of how we should think about human embryos. And it's not just a question, a debate between pro-choice and pro-life folks here. The question we reflected on in session two, okay, unfortunately pushes itself upon us here as well. How should we think about human embryos? What are they? Should we be concerned about what researchers do with them? It may be useful to make a distinction between open and closed embryo. Some people think that an important event occurs in the life of an embryo about 14 days. Some call this the primitive streak event, when cells begin a process of differentiating in particular types of tissue. The embryo begins to show hints of a shape signifying polarity. I prefer to talk in terms of openness and closeness. An open embryo is an embryo which has the potential for creating an indefinite number of new embryos through blastomere separation or fusing with another embryo to create a single embryo from two or more. A closed embryo is an embryo which has differentiated to the point where it can neither divide into two or more embryos, nor fuse into one. Some people make much of this radical shift from openness to closeness in the embryo and argue that research on open embryos should be allowed since there is no singular definite human being present. Others argue that this distinction between open and closed embryos is a red herring, a distraction from the central idea that destroying human embryos, open or closed, still amounts to the destruction of human life that otherwise have most likely thrived in the world. Okay, so now the case study real quick. We'll read it as quickly as I can. You're a member of the HEFA, a powerful board established, this is in Britain, to regulate the use of genetic technologies in the UK. Ian Wilmot and Paul D'Souza have come to the board to request permission to clone human embryos to do research on motor neuron. They want to clone embryos using tissue from sufferers of motor neuron disease so they can learn something about the developmental mechanisms of this disease. You've located enough women willing to donate eggs for this project or are ready to proceed with the research if HEFA will agree. HEFA has already granted one license to clone human embryos to a lab in Newcastle, but you are having doubts about the morality of this kind of research. You've just finished some research on human reproduction and have had great difficulty working out in your own mind how to think about human embryos. Dr. Wilmot makes the following argument. The best way to learn about this disease is to clone human embryos. If we can understand this disease, we can cure it. Thousands of people and their families will benefit. He's done. That's the argument. Dr. Wilmot's remarks are simple, compelling, but somehow unsatisfying to you. As you look around the room, you see that you probably be the swing vote in this case. Bioethicist Andre Bonnickson wrote about human embryos, "We cannot talk about germline therapy without considering the policies on embryo research. And much of the concern relates to the sanctity or non-sanctity of the embryo. What the embryo is will determine what people believe about what should be done with it." Discuss, okay? Mary Malwald, this is, see what you think about this suggestion. Suggested in American Journal of Bioethics that it might make a moral difference if researchers allowed embryos to die before extracting the stem cells, preserving the letting, die, killing distinction. She also suggested that some form of ritual at the disposal of embryos used in this way might allay the moral concerns of some groups. Here's the quote. "Allowing embryos to die before retrieving their stem cells thus provides a means by which some individuals can preserve their moral integrity. Extra embryos may also be dealt with respectfully or disrespectfully. Presumably the notion of respect or disrespect for early embryos makes no sense for those who regard them as having no moral value or status. For those who do, however, respectful disposal is surely possible." So she's saying that if you can find some way of respectfully disposing of the embryos that you've killed, that might help the, you know, help some groups feel better about it, and so on. Three, there have been recent suggestions on how to derive stem cells from embryos without destroying them. One idea is to remove one cell from the embryo derived from stem four from that instead of destroying the whole embryo. Would this process solve the problem? Well, it wouldn't, because as soon as you pull that cell out, as I said yesterday, it becomes a de facto embryo in the sense that it's totipotent, and would, for people who believe in the position of the pro-life movement, that that's as morally significant as the embryo that you've just pulled out. It is, in a sense, an identical twin of the embryo. Once you pull that cell out, it will divide and become an embryo. So, the debate about embryo-derived stem cells is part of a larger conversation about embryos in general. When we do research on embryos, they die. When we use embryos in IVF, many are destroyed or stored and later destroyed, or stored and later destroyed. When we derive stem cells from embryos, the embryo dies. What is your best thinking about how we should develop policies that affect human embryos? And in the Psalms, the passage, "For you formed my inward parts, you wove me in my mother's womb." Okay. Reflect on the role the Bible might play in your own religious tradition and how the Bible is generally interpreted in your community. How might this passage bear or not bear on your thinking about embryos? There's the case. You are having to decide about whether or not to allow a license here to clone human embryos with the intention of doing research on them.
Mm-hmm. I have kind of I'll add another one here. You end up banning the research, but another country allows it and comes up with a something that can cure something. Do you use it?
Do you use the cure? I think Jill, we talked about this at the church. I don't know if you remember that conversation we had at the church. Remember about this? But you folks were there about that similar kind of subject. I remember how it came up there.
I didn't want to distract from that, but it was just kind of a corollary question in my mind.
An embryo is not going to be a person unless it's put into a womb and cared for by somebody. So, I mean, evolution biology is always producing many, many more lives than it intends to have survive. I mean, you look at a plant, you look at a frog, and even people. Like, how many eggs does a woman's body have? Nature never intended for every one of those eggs to become a person. It's not possible. And so here we've made ourselves a situation where, you know, we can take this egg outside of somebody's body, and now we could potentially, I suppose we'll eventually create some sort of mechanical womb, and we can bring an embryo to fruition, to a baby outside of a natural womb. Does that mean that we're responsible for every single egg and sperm that a human body produces, and now these all have to be sacred and brought to
sperm is sacred, every sperm is great. If one sperm is wasted, God gets quite irate.
Yeah.
You can't. Nature has designed itself with the idea of a great deal of waste.
Right. So yeah, and that film is kind of a satire. It was kind of sending up the Catholic view on there. So there's like 100 kids in the house, and they're all singing it. Every sperm is sacred, you know. And then he sits them down and says, you know, I'm sorry, got to make a decision. I'm selling you all for medical experiments. You know? So, but anyway, I'll help make your case even stronger, and then take it away a little bit, or take a little bite out of it. It turns out there's not just eggs and sperm, but the latest research that I've seen anyway indicates that the likelihood of any particular conception, actually getting from conception to birth, is 50% at best,
yeah.
Maybe less.
So even after it's fertilized.
And many of these turn out to be nature
defective.
Dealing with trisomal non...
non viable
sleep.
The
disease that we usually think of as a trisomal that everyone.
Like
Down syndrome. Non-Down syndrome trisomal, where things could be a lot more difficult. That nature just sort of takes care of these as miscarriages, some of which you don't even know happening, right?
Yeah.
So that seems to be the case. And for some people, like Hans Küng, a theologian, Catholic theologian, this was a morally significant scientific fact for him. This was. For other people, it's just not, because as soon as you bring in human intentionality, everything is changed. What our decision-making processes then turn that thing on its head and simply say, if we participate in the process of us deciding that we are going to destroy it. That's a very different thing than it happening spontaneously. So, and for some it may be morally significant that this is the case. Does that lead you to the conclusion that research on human embryos, whatever it might be, despite all of the concerns that these bioethics commissions have and so on, human embryos are not, there's nothing particularly special about a human embryo.
Like this guy who's gonna clone all these defective embryos so he can study the defect, right? If he didn't do that, all those defective embryos wouldn't exist. You know,
they would produce humans who end up more than likely with ALS.
But they wouldn't, because they wouldn't be there, because he wouldn't be there cloning them. It's his research that causes them to come into an existence in this abundance. So, I mean, if you tell him not to do that, then I guess you don't have the problem of destroying them. But if he's not going to produce them if they're not going to be, then what's the difference if they aren't going to be because he destroyed them during research, or they aren't going to be because he didn't make them in the first place? It's the same thing like with eating a cow. Well, you know, we shouldn't eat a cow because it's a life and all this, but... You know, if it wasn't for people who wouldn't have produced all these cows, there would be maybe, you know, a million cows in the whole world. They're not that bright. But because we nurture and protect them...
We don't know
them,
that. We're not a cow.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, because we nurture and protect them, now there's gazillions of them. And, you know, so, I mean, our agency is there in bringing these things to be. So does it matter that our agency is there in what we choose to do with them?
What I understand, they contribute more to global warming than cars do, actually.
Well,
that's another subject. Okay.
I mean, it's kind of a sticky wicket. Well, what difference does it make? It's not gonna exist if he doesn't do this.
But that same argument says you can kill your kids.
You brought
them into being.
Okay. So what she's done, by the way, in the parlance of ethics and so on, is she's She's offering an analogy. And analogies are very powerful, but they aren't necessarily, so you have to be real careful about analogy. You want to dissect them and look at them very, very carefully. So let's back up just a little bit here and just ask the question then about human embryos. You talked about them, what was the phrase you used? I wanted to use as well about they aren't going to become, or they aren't going to be, or they aren't going to...
Yeah, they're going to not be.
Okay.
They're in existence.
Then, now remember, we do have religious traditions represented here, and they do have for a long time had some ideas and concepts about what it means to come to be a person, right? And it often is associated with the concept of a soul or something. What is it that makes something come to be a person? Is it when it implants? Is it when they meet together? Is it in the, like with the Bible passage? Is it in the mind of God before conception? Is it at birth? Is there some sort of magic point at birth when they take that first breath that they are? Now, are we asking a question that is simply, let's toss a bunch of coins and decide where to do it? There's nothing that we can use to really back up something that would end up with some kind of consensus? Or are we having a conversation that might actually lead us somewhere? Now, we're now on the verge, though, of a conversation that could be very difficult because it does play into the old abortion debate. So, yeah, here and then there was a hand back.
I'm not sure. I don't have a Jewish background, but my understanding is that the Jewish tradition is that a child is not a child until like about a month afterwards, and I think they attach it to the stirring of the child in the womb. Movement. Is that
before you feel quickening?
Yeah. Quickening.
Right.
And so for them, there is no moral problem with working with embryos.
Yeah, and the history of the abortion debate, interesting, from the 18th century, from the beginning of the 19th century to the beginning of the 20th century, there went from there being almost no real laws regulating this to every state in the Union having some kind of laws regulating abortion. And legally wrestling, quickening, they call it, was a substantial part of this, as was the interest of the medical establishment to try and make sure that people who didn't have licenses couldn't practice. There's some political debate there that ends up having significant for the abortion debate. But we can do that if we want. We can talk about the Buddhists, the Jews, the Jewish traditions, or have different ideas about these things. But are we talking about something that is, again, just pick a religion type of thing, or is there something that we might be able to agree on conceptually as we work this thing through that would bear on this question of embryonic research, human embryo research? Well, that's what I'm trying to get at here. Yes, the Mac.
Well, I'll throw this into the pot. You can take it out if you like. There's been a lot of interesting research and theories recently on human consciousness by Edelman and others, trying to understand how it is the material object that we call the brain produces the phenomenon of consciousness. And I throw that in because, if we're trying to come up with some scientific notion of a soul or an objective notion of a soul, would we want to try to relate it to consciousness, the phenomenon of consciousness?
Yeah. I'm going to throw out an analogy, so be careful, push me in this, so that thing. Many people who are pro-choice don't understand why a person in a pro-life position ends up in what seems to be completely irrational kinds of statements, like even if it's a rape, you got to have the kid kind of a thing, or so on. And even in the endangerment of the mother, there can be kind of ambiguity there. In part, it's something that, normally speaking, if there's a person in the room we don't kill them because they are a product of a rape or something of that sort. So if you carry the logic back, you see what I'm saying there. So then developmentally now, if we talk about different stages, and I'm telling you, and Don will confirm this too, I think that ethicists have tried to figure everything they can from the conception all the way to the birth, some event that they could look at that would somehow reveal some inherent thing, attribute of the fetus, the embryo or the fetus, that would warrant our shift from looking at it as an object to treating it as a subject. Some think of it as, you know, when the heart starts beating. Some think of it as when the brain develops, like you're saying there. The old, you know, if I only had a brain, you know, would you treat me with respect if I only had a brain? Do you have to have a brain? It sounds bizarre for me to be saying this, I'm sure to you, but do you have to, you know, you normally if we don't have our arms or our legs or so on, or we're disabled in some way, we still see that there's a person there, right? If there's no brain, do we have the same, is there some special thing going on with the brain here that's connected with being a person, that without that, there's just nothing there. Do you have to have a brain? Right? So if you look along that continuum.
But the trouble is you still have the potential for a brain. Like if you didn't intervene, there would be a brain.
Well, there are,
so
and it's about birth.
So is that the same as having a brain? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you maybe remember Loma Linda. I think it must be 20 years now. Where a couple decided to, they knew they were going to have an anencephalic birth, that is to say, a baby that's born with only
the
basic brain stem. There's no brain, there's no possibility of it developing into an active, you know, alert human being. They chose to have the baby, but again, I called it a baby, didn't I? See, we have all these things that trick us into thinking certain ways. And they wanted to keep it alive on life support long enough for the organs to develop so they could then harvest the organ from the body to then at least have some meaning to the birth by benefiting other kids who needed organs.
On the brain thing, we have the thing at the other end of life, brain dead.
Yeah.
We don't kill a person, but we allow them to die, I think, don't we?
Well, yeah, and the debate about allowing, that distinction between allowing to die and killing, I think, is personally, I find it a kind of bogus.
Yes.
Because again, once you have the power and the knowledge, and you're in a position there, your decision to do things, there's a responsibility.
Well, I was thinking more on the brain thing.
Right.
When they're brain dead, we almost say they're not a person anymore.
Right, and then we rely on machines to see. Blips, you know, there are enough blips on the screen for us to think that there's someone there, you know, who we could theoretically address, right? Mm-hmm. So, Joe?
Yeah.
We need to.
No, I've got so many things to remember here. Mm-hmm. Just real quickly, as far as, you know, where is it okay to do research, I guess, my personal feeling is, kind of goes along a little bit with this, it doesn't matter if it's when it becomes human, but when whatever form it is has, you know, fear or consciousness or pain, can experience pain or fear or consciousness of that pain, you know, those things. So that even if it's an animal, once you're inflicting pain on something that feels the pain and is aware of it or whatever, that's a problem research-wise for me. And I know maybe we can't know when that is, but that's when it becomes a problem for me. Now, I just wanted to play the little thought experiment that Don did yesterday with his youngest daughter. Because really, to me, it's solely a religious, faith-related thing. You know, if you believe, like the pro-life movement does, that you know, the second of conception is ensoulment or whatever, and is a full human being, of course you're going to see it as the same as any of us. But if we have Don's youngest daughter, and he learns that she has, you know, the ALS gene, and she's going to get ALS in 5 years, but they're about to do genetic testing on an embryo that would provide a cure for this. And the embryo looks like the little 8-cell blastocyst. It hasn't been implanted. Nothing is formed yet. Can you say, you know what, that is just as valuable as my daughter with her rich experience and her personality and her feelings and consciousness, and therefore I'm going to let my daughter suffer this horrendous, slow, long, painful death to preserve this 8-cell
thing.
And do our theological traditions, in a sense, suggest that? That what we're supposed to do, I was only half joking when I used the Bible passage there yesterday, is it the case that we are called upon to transcend our own immediate spheres of interest, ourselves, our spouse, our children, in the biological, or in my case, adopted sense, you know, of a family, and to view everyone the same, to be called upon to review, to actually view and act towards everyone as though they were our brothers or sisters or family. If that's the case, you see what I'm saying is that
you include in everyone the eight cells.
That's what our conversation is about right now. Is about, and, but I'm saying that this is not just a problem for religious communities. It's not just a problem for religious communities. This puzzle that I'm talking about in terms of human origins, not human origins, personal origins. My tutor at Oxford wrote two books, one, Personal Being, Social Being, and on, you know, when do we acknowledge a person in the human, because it doesn't necessarily have to be human. I do this thought experiment in class often where I say, what would you do if I unzipped my chest and all of a sudden you saw, like in Star Trek, you know, one of the series, you know, where there's all kinds of bells, whistles going on in there. And there's no difference at all in terms of my behavior, my class, your the buildup of trust that you'd had in me, and so on and so on. There's no difference, except I don't have a carbon-based way of making that happen. It's just there. In other words, do we worship carbon-based, you know, or is it the person? It's clearly the person. When you guys came in, I didn't test to make sure, you know, do my Dr. McCoy scan to make sure you had an actual brain. I don't know if you have brains or not, or if you have that thing, or neurons and so on and so forth, right? You came in, you behaved a certain...
We've been worried about you, too.
Yeah, for good reason there. I do have... No. So, all I'm saying is that, what do we scan for? One thing, two things. Rough appearance that looks similar, and behavior. And even the thing about looking similar, you know, have you seen the Elephant Man? You know, I mean, one thing what we scan for more important than anything else is behavior. You know, if you end up with that, so you take all of that stuff, and then you think about being a human. Look, I mean, here's the problem for me as being a person, is that we, this is a terrible time to start to say this right now, but is that to be a human being, in the morally relevant sense of being a person, is to begin consciousness in the middle of a story. We begin in the middle. We've always begun in the middle. We've never begun at the beginning. As soon as we become aware of ourselves as human beings, as persons, we're in the middle of it. And life and development goes for us both directions. Questions about our origins and questions about our future. And the questions about our origins, I'm saying, is part of this debate. It's not just about biology, it's about mythology, but not mythology in the sense of true or false or historical and historical, but mythology in the sense of understanding who we are as persons. Once you get that, you realize that the debate about where it is in the biological spectrum, it's all nonsense. It's nothing. You're never going to find anything that does that. Nothing. Brain, heart, anything, this is sort of the work of it. There's nothing there. It's not going to be there. You're not going to find that location. Whether you're religious community or not, you're not going to find it. And yet we have laws against killing each other, so we have some concept that being a person is extremely valuable, more valuable than anything else, apparently, you know, in terms of our laws and so on. It's a pretty high thing, you know, killing someone.
So are you saying that it's wherever you draw the line, whether it's viability, birth, quickening, it's going to be arbitrary.
Truly arbitrary.
It's going to be, it's not going to satisfy
everyone.
No, it's not going to satisfy, for me, it's not going to satisfy the question that's being asked.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's well, in principle unanswerable that way.
I think the problem is that always it's been sort of nature or God or whatever our concept was that somehow mysteriously brought the egg and the sperm together, and then mysteriously everybody had this personality And now we've teased that all out, and we're getting the tools to make that happen into our own hands, and all of a sudden now we're God.
Yeah.
In a real sense. Like, I can take my little blast assistant, I can have 8 kids now, and they're all the same. And that used to be not our responsibility. You know, we didn't get to make a choice about that. It was somewhere in the cosmos that was getting decided. And
well, yeah. And I think, I mean, the last thing I want to say is that the Catholic solution to these questions, because they have them, may be very unsatisfying to you. But because they have a very long philosophical history and background, they've at least thought about these kinds of questions in a way I don't see in other traditions yet. And I don't think that their solutions are satisfying to me, but I've learned a lot by reading the scholastics on these kinds of things, philosophically and theologically, without necessarily coming to the conclusion that the solution is not to use birth control or something. But I'm just saying that all of that history and debate and discussion isn't just about whether you should use a condom or not. It really is. It's about a lot of stuff. And this is one of the things it's about. It's about articulating our origins as human persons.
But if your perceived mandate is a simple black and white solution, that's how you get there.
Yeah. And there's politics. Okay, I mean, I'm aware that there's all kinds of things that influence the bringing to closure in some policy way these questions. But if you articulate those and bracket them out, there's still a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and then there's even the other question of, okay, so we have religious traditions about this and what we can learn from the religious traditions, but those religious traditions might have nothing to do with person A or B over here. I mean, it's a religious tradition, and in our country, that doesn't need to be necessarily acknowledged through government law.
Unless you're talking about marriage.
Yeah, another issue. But, you know, how, even if we decide on the basis of a belief in faith, where does that get us on a policy level? It's like, well, not very far, really.
I think it gets us to at least an encouragement, if not a mandate, for our leaders to spend more time and people who are in the pastorate doing things like we're doing right now, spending more time doing them.
Do you have hope that these things will be satisfactorily answered?
Well, being a person of faith, whether I do or not, I feel like I'm obligated to do them. But yeah, I think I'm also, apart from that, an optimist. I've seen things work in small ways, in discussions that we've had along the way that have had impact on policy in bioethics. Third-year PTs ended up as projects for our class, submitting things to the Oregon Board of Physical Therapy that ended up being adopted into the policy and changed for the good, the thing. So, I guess based on the modest kinds of experience that I have to say yes. It's much more difficult, though, when you're talking about these kinds of things where the regulation would seem to have to be able to take seriously something that's very hard to take seriously at the level of law, which is intention, motivation, and so on and so forth. What's the motive in having an abortion? How are you going to regulate saying yes or no to an abortion based on what you believe their intentions were in having the abortion? I don't know how not to have that conversation, especially given what we talked about today, the possibility of people having abortions to do all kinds of pretty awful things if they felt like it. I don't know. Sorry to have taken 15 minutes.
Thank you.
Yep.